From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as our Country Music Week continues, we hear from two performers who are almost opposites in their public identities. Merle Haggard is a country star who, as a young man, lived the kind of life that's often mythologized in song, hopping freights and doing prison time. Singer Don Walser has lived a much straighter life, a family man. He made his living working for the National Guard in the state of Texas until retiring in 1994. Only since then has he become nationally known for his beautiful ballads, infectious Western swing tunes, and lilting yodels. Also today, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new biography of Helen Keller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. One day after Wall Street's second worst ever one-day loss, at 512-point plunge that sent some panicky investors running for the showers, trading remains volatile. NPR's business correspondent Jack Spear joins me. Jack, what's the news on Wall Street today? What are experts saying?
Well, Korva, volatility is probably the understatement of the day. As one analyst in New York put it, this gives new meaning to the term volatility on Wall Street. We have seen very sharp ups and downs for the financial markets today. After yesterday's big 500-point plunge, in fact, the market was up a little bit after the open, then down, and now it is up again. So we haven't regained everything, but we're up nearly 200 points last time I looked.
The American economy is doing well. As a matter of fact, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin has repeated that assertion. So why are these markets down so much?
Yeah, as did President Clinton today in Moscow when he said the economy is fundamentally sound. What is going on, Korva, as near as most analysts can tell, is that people are still worried about the possible impact of Asia and what's going on in Russia on corporate earnings. You saw some of that yesterday when the last sector of the market where we were still seeing some profits sold off, a high technology sector. And, of course, the NASDAQ suffered its worst single-point drop yesterday.
So what can we expect next? What can individual or small investors expect?
I'm afraid what we can expect next is continued uncertainty in terms of the markets anyway. We're going to see continued gyrations, I'm afraid, for a while to come. There is some consensus on Wall Street now that we are testing the bottom of where the market may fall, and we'll see some more ups and downs in the weeks to come. But I would expect that investors will still have to hold on.
Thanks, Jack. NPR's business correspondent, Jack Spear. A new survey on drug use by teenagers finds that children are the most vulnerable when they turn 13. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
This is one more back-to-school survey that teachers and parents did not want to hear about, but probably needed to. The Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University in New York reports that when children turn 13, they come in contact with a lot more teenagers who sell and use acid, cocaine, or heroin. Their access to hard drugs goes way up, but the likelihood that 13-year-olds are going to talk to their parents about drug use is practically nil. One big reason, teens say, is that parents aren't around. The survey also shows that the transition from 12 to 13 signals the biggest increase in tobacco, marijuana, and alcohol use, and yet school officials are in serious denial, the report says. It's the third year in a row that the vast majority of teenagers report an increase in drug use. I'm Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Authorities in Southern California report wildfires are burning thousands of acres there. Flames have eaten at least 26 homes in Riverside County. Many residents had no time to save possessions and barely enough time to flee. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 180 points at 7,719. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Food and Drug Administration recommends that people who are at high risk of developing foodborne illnesses stay away from alfalfa sprouts. NPR's Rebecca Pearl reports.
The FDA says that young children, the elderly, and people with compromised immune systems shouldn't eat alfalfa sprouts because they've been linked to outbreaks of E. coli and salmonella. The report follows recent outbreaks in California that made about 60 people sick. In California, a statewide advisory has been issued. E. coli infections in vulnerable populations can cause kidney failure and even death. Salmonella infections can cause serious illnesses in these groups as well. Federal officials say the International Sprout Growers Association is taking positive steps to address the problem, including developing ways to reduce bacterial contamination contamination of seeds. Rebecca Pearl, NPR News, Washington.
A much-watched index of the country's future economic activity finds the United States economy is still expanding. The private business research group, the Conference Board, reports the index of leading economic indicators rose 0.4% in July, ending a two-month decline. But the board warns this report does not include recent drops in the stock market, and that will affect the August report. Meanwhile, the nation's manufacturers reported slower activity last month. The National Association of Purchasing Management says the manufacturing sector slowed down in August for the third month in a row. This three-month contraction comes after 22 months of growth. Now on Wall Street, the Dow's up 200 at 7739. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Country Music Week on our show. No one in contemporary popular music has created a more impressive legacy or one that spans a wider variety of styles than Merle Haggard, according to music critic Peter Guralnick. Haggard's best-known songs include Mama Tried, The Bottle Let Me Down, Okie from Muskogee, and Today I Started Loving You Again. As a young man, Haggard was in and out of prison and hardly seemed destined for success. Those prison experiences are reflected in many of the songs in his repertoire. Before we hear a 1995 interview with Merle Haggard, let's hear him sing one of the songs he wrote that he's best known for, Mama Tried.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama Tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Merle Haggard, is this song autobiographical?
Well, it really is very, very close. At least there's some things we fudged on slightly to make it rhyme, but the majority of it, I'd say 97% of it's pretty accurate, I guess.
Your father died when you were 9, is that right?
9.
So right. Your mother had to raise you alone after that.
Yeah, and I was to say the least, probably the most incorrigible child you could think of. I was already on the way to prison before I realized it. Actually, I was really kind of a screw up, but I really don't know why. I think it was mostly just out of boredom and lack of a father's attention, I think.
I think you were 14 when your mother put you in a juvenile home.
No, she didn't put me in a juvenile home. The authorities put me in there for truancy, for not going to school, and they gave me 6 months in like a road camp situation, and I ran off from there and stole a car, and then the next time I went back, it was for something serious, and then I spent the next 7 years running off from places. I think I escaped 17 times from different institutions in California. And all it was just a matter of the authorities running me off. And, you know, they drumming up business for themselves. I really feel sorry for the way they do some of the kids, you know. And I was one of those kids. I'm going to snitch on them if I get a chance.
How would you escape from reform school and youth institutions?
Well, there was different institutions and different methods. There was some of them were minimum security, some were maximum security, and Some of them were kid joints, and some of them were adult jailhouses. And I just didn't stay nowhere. I was just, I think Willie Sutton was my idol, if you don't know, you know. At the time, I was in the middle of becoming an outlaw and escaping from jail and escaping from places that they had me locked up in was part of the thing that I wanted to do.
No, was there an outlaw mystique that you wanted to have?
I guess. I don't know. I admired people like Jesse James, you know, along with a lot of other kids, but I guess I took it too far, you know.
So what was your most ingenious escape?
Probably the one that was the most ingenious was one that I didn't actually go on. I was San Quentin. I was all set to go with the only completely successful escape out of San Quentin, I think, in 21 years. But the people that gave me the chance to go were the same people that talked me out of it because they felt like that I was just doing it for the sport of it, and then it was a very serious thing to the other fellow that was going, and they had a big judge's chamber sort of desk that they were building at the furniture factory in San Quentin, and I had a friend who was building a place for two guys to be transported out. That was before they had x-rays and things of that nature, and they just, and I could have gone, and I didn't go, and the guy that I went with wound up being executed in the gas chamber. He went out and held court in the street, killed a highway patrolman, and so it was really good that I didn't go.
Was that a real sobering experience for you?
Yeah, I've had a lot of those things in my life, and, you know, those are the sort of things that... that a guy unknowingly like myself, I guess I was gathering up meat for songs, you know. I don't know what I was doing. I really kind of was crazy as a kid, and then all of a sudden, you know, and while I was in San Quentin, I just, I one day understood that I saw the light, and I just didn't want to do that no more, and I realized what a mess I'd made out of my life, and I got out of there and stayed out of there. Never to go back, and went and apologized to all the people I'd wronged and tried to pay back the people that I'd taken money from, borrowed money from, or whatever. And I think when I was 31 years old, I paid everybody back that I'd ever taken anything from, and, including my mother.
What did you say to your mother when you changed your life around?
But it was just obvious. No, there was no. I don't think there was ever any time that anybody in my family was worried about me staying with this. It was just the way that, you know, some people grow up in the Army, and you know, it's hard to be 18 years old, and you know, they send 18-year-old boys to war because they don't know what to do with them, and I was one that I wound up going to prison rather than war. And instead of growing up in the middle of a battlefield with bullets flying around me, I grew up on the isolation ward, death row. And that's what the song Mama Tried gets close to being autobiographical.
You were on death row?
Yeah, I was. I got caught for making beer. Making some beer up there, and I got too much of my own beer and got drunk in the yard and got arrested. And it's hard to get arrested in San Quentin, but I did. And they sent me to what was known as the Shelf, and the Shelf is a part of the North Block, which you share with the inmates on death row. And it's kind of like the... there's not too many more stops for you, actually, you know. And that was the, as you put it, sobering experience for me. I wound up with nothing to lay on except a Bible and an old concrete slab, and woke up from that drunk that I'd been on that day, and I could hear some prisoners talking in the area next to me. In other words, there was a alleyway between the back of the cells, and I could hear people talking over there, and I recognized the guy as being Carroll Chessman, a guy that they were fixing to execute. And I don't know, it was just something about the whole situation that I knew that if I ever got out of there, if I was lucky enough to get out, I made up my mind while I still had that hangover that I was all finished.
How were you lucky enough to get out?
Well, I went back down on the yard and went down and asked for the roughest job in the penitentiary, which was a textile mill. And went down and just started building my reputation, you know, just started running in reverse from what I'd been doing and started trying to build up a long line of good things to be proud of, and that's what I've been doing since then.
Back in the days when you were in prison, was music a big part of your life then? Were you singing, playing, writing songs?
Yeah. Yeah, I was already into doing that. I really didn't, believe that I sincerely had a future in it. I think I was just kind of like doing what I thought was probably a waste of time or a hobby at the very most, and maybe some extra money on the weekend sort of thing. But that's when I was in San Quentin. I still didn't really thoroughly realize that I had to do this the rest of my life and that it was going to be this successful for me and I was going to, you know, have all the things happen that have happened. I had no idea that you could never have convinced me of a minute amount of the success I've had. I would never have believed it.
Did your musical ability have anything to do with people noticing you in prison and thinking that you could make it when you got out? I mean, did that help you at all in the war?
Yeah, that was the basic reason, I think, that these friends of mine talked me out of going on that escape. I mean, they felt that I had talent, and they felt that I was just a ornery kid and could probably make something out of my life. And you know, believe it or not, in the penitentiary, just some pretty nice people and very unfortunate people. And they love to let somebody, so to speak, get up on their shoulders. You know, they like to boost somebody over the wall if they can. If they can't make it themselves, they, I think, sincerely love to see someone else make it. I finally made a successful escape, you might say.
My guest is Merle Haggard. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to our 1995 interview with Merle Haggard, let's hear him sing another song he wrote, The Bottle Let Me Down.
Each night I leave the bar room when it's over, not feeling any pain at closing time. But tonight your memory found me much too sober. Couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind. Tonight the bottle let me down. Come around.
down.
Tell us the story how you got your first guitar.
My first guitar?
Yeah. Or how you started to play guitar.
Well,
as it was.
I have an older brother named Lowell, and Lowell had a service station at the time, and there was a guy who came in and wanted a couple of dollars worth of gas and didn't have no money, and he left a little Bronson, sort of a Stella Sears and Roebuck type guitar, as collateral, and he never did come back after it. And that old guitar sat in the closet there for a couple of years, and finally, I think my mother showed me a couple of chords. My brother didn't know how to play, and my dad had passed away. He was a musician in the family, so Mama showed me C chord that Daddy had showed her, and she didn't know how to make C chord very good. But I took it from that, and I beat around on that old Bronson. I think it was a Bronson guitar.
I imagine when you first got the guitar, you were playing the songs that you heard on the radio. How did you start writing songs yourself?
Well, about the same time that I discovered Jimmy Rogers, I was about 12 years old, I discovered Hank Williams. And I remember seeing on the Yellow MGM records there was the artist's name, and then there was another name underneath that artist. It was a small, very small letters, and it said composer, and I didn't know what a composer was. I asked my mother, I said, what does this mean? She said, I don't know, and she called the record store, and they told her, that's the writer, that's the guy that writes the songs. And it seemed to me that it was very important to have your name in both places there. I noticed that Hank Williams had a little extra clout because he wrote his own songs. Jimmy Rogers, the same thing, you know. And so I felt it was just as necessary to become a songwriter as it was to try to learn to play the guitar. It was certainly a tool that most people, I think, in the business would like to be a singer-songwriter if they could be, because it is in some way your retirement. You know, you can have a great career, and if you don't write songs or have a publishing company or something to lean back on when it's all over, it's a pretty hard drop back to reality, you know. And once you've learned to live under the conditions I've learned to live on, you better have yourself a publishing company or I'll have to go back to being an outlaw.
When you started writing songs, did you realize that you could write autobiographical songs from your own life, or did you think you had to copy other people's songs?
Well, I really didn't realize what method to take at first. I must have wrote maybe 1,500 songs that weren't any good, or at least I never kept them, and finally with a lot of help and a lot of people who had written hit songs who I'd become friends with, such as Fuzzy Owen, who became my personal manager. It was a songwriter, and he helped me. He taught me how to write songs, and finally I wrote one that was worth keeping, and I think I've written about 300 keepers or so, maybe 400.
Do you remember the first one that you felt this is worth keeping?
Yeah, it was a sort of a rock and roll song, or a Elvis-type rock and roll thing. It was called If You Want to Be My Woman. And Glenn Campbell opened his shows with it for years, and I still do the song. And I wrote it when I was about 14. But I didn't keep very many. That was probably one out of that 1,500 that got kept.
Could you sing a couple of bars of it?
You like riding in the country in my Cadillac, and you keep, I keep pushing, you keep pushing me back. Something about On the money that I earned, but you refused to give me something equal in return. Don't look at me like maybe you don't understand. If you want to be my woman, you know you got to let me be your man.
And how old were you when you wrote
something
it?
Something like that.
How old were you?
14.
Wow. So this is just about the time that you started that whole round of reform schools.
Yeah. I might have been as much as 15 or 16 when I wrote that song. It was between 14 and 17. I'm not sure.
Was it hard for you to adjust to success and stardom, having come from poverty and, you know, having lived in prison off and on for so many years? I think it's hard for a lot of people to adjust to that.
Well, you know, a lot of people may or may not understand how hard it is for a person coming out of an institution, you know, whether it be a prison or whether it be some sort of a mental institution, whether it be the Army or whatever. There's a thing that happens, like when you leave the penitentiary, when you've been there for 3 years, you have friends and you have a way of life and you have a routine and a whole way of life that you just give up all of a sudden. One day you're there and you're next day you're not there, and you don't have any more friends from the outside because things went on when you left and you can't find anybody there, and the people you left behind in prison are really your only friends. And there's a period of adjustment that took me about 120 days, I don't know, about 4 months. A couple of times I really wanted to go back. It's really a weird sensation. It's the loneliest feeling in the world about the second night out of the penitentiary.
Merle Haggard, recorded in 1995. He's currently on tour. Some of the cities he'll play this month are Laredo, Corpus Christi, Austin, Houston, Zanesville, Wichita Falls, and Oklahoma City. Let's hear a song Haggard wrote with Buck Owens. This is a version Haggard recorded in the 90s. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Today I started loving you again, and I'm right back where I've really always been. I got over you just long enough to let my heart ache mend, and then today I started loving you again. What a fool I was to think I could get by with only these few mere tears I cried. I should have known the worst was yet to come, and the trying time for me had just begun. Today I started loving you again, and I'm right back where I've really always been. I got over you just long enough to let my heart ache mend, and then today I started loving you again.
Coming up, the country ballads, swing tunes, and yodeling of Don Walser. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new Helen Keller biography. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Country Music Week on our show. Country music styles have come and gone. Don Walser says he's still singing the same way he did back in the 50s, when he sometimes shared the bill with a young Buddy Holly in small Texas towns. Walser has a gift for singing ballads and for yodeling, but he never made it commercially, so he kept his day job. He worked in the National Guard as a mechanic and administrator, then worked for the state of Texas. He retired in 1994 when he turned 60. His retirement coincided with his first commercially released recording, Rolling Stone from Texas, on the Austin-based label Watermelon. Walser's lived in Austin since the late 80s, where he has developed a large following among alternative rock fans as well as fans of classic country music. Before we feature a 1994 interview with Don Walser, let's hear his recording of the yodeling cowboy ballad, Cowpoke.
I'm lonesome, but I'm happy. Rich, but I'm broke, and the good Lord knows the reason. I'm just a cowboy from Dallas to Austin. The ranges I know, I drift with the wind. No one cares where I go.
Don Walser, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be talking with you today.
What happens to your voice when you yodel? How do you do it?
Well, it's kind of done down in your throat, and you hit a falsetto, and then you just come right back out of it to something else, you know. You know, like, you know, it sounds kind of dumb when you're doing it like that, but then if you speed it up, it's, you see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Well, you do an Eddie Arnold song, I'll Hold You in My Heart Till I Can Hold You in My Arms. And one of the things I love about your version of this song is that you don't yodel in the song, but you use that kind of falsetto yodel-like quality in the melody. You just, like, work it into the melody line.
Right. That was Ray Benson's idea. Him and T.J. McFarlane produced this CD, and he said, why don't you try a falsetto on the end of it and just do the melody? He'd heard me do it before on other songs. And so I have to blame that on him. That wasn't the way I usually sung it. But I'm glad that he came up with the idea, because I really enjoy it.
Well, this is I'll Hold You in My Heart from Don Walser's new album, Rolling Stone from Texas.
And
It's really a beautiful recording. Don Walser, I'd like to get back to your yodeling for a moment. Do you feel like you know different styles of yodeling, or is there just one style that's the Don Walser style?
Well, I think that I do a Jimmy Rogers type yodel. I think we put one, yeah, we did. We put California Blues on there, and it's a different kind of yodel. But I sort of do a Swiss yodel. And I kind of patterned that after hearing the Jimmy Wakely song that Slim Whitman did back in the late 40s, I believe it was. I believe it was in the late 40s that he did Casting My Lasso. And I liked that Swiss yodel, and I started doing that more. And, of course, Elton Britt did some things like Cannonball Yodel and stuff like that got me to doing that.
What's the difference between a Swiss yodel and a cowboy yodel? And maybe you could demonstrate the difference for us.
Well, a cowboy yodel is sort of like, sort of like that, you know. And then a Swiss yodel is more like, you know, it's more of a double yodel than the cowboy yodel is. You know, like an old cowboy song. I remember I used to do one when I was growing up called Rainbow in the Rio Colorado, and it has a kind of different yodel to it too. And I don't know, it's just I just sort of developed a lot of the yodels because I didn't have access out there where I grew up to anyone else's yodels, and I still haven't really paid much attention. I've been, you know, so busy throughout my life that I really hadn't bought and listened to other folks yodeling.
Take us back to your childhood a little bit. Would you describe for us where you grew up?
I grew up in a little farming community of La Mesa, Texas, right between Lubbock and Big Spring, out on the South Plains of Texas, a little strip of land right below the Panhandle. And my mother passed away when I was about not quite 12 years old. And in those days, the Lubbock County and up in there had a lot of cotton. And the old La Mesa Cotton Oil Mill was where my father worked, and he was the night superintendent. And back in those days, when the mill run, well, you had to be there all the time. So he worked from 6 in the afternoon, in the evening, until 6 in the morning, 7 days a week while the mill was running, and that usually was at least 6 to 8 months during the year, and sometimes even longer, according to the size of the crop.
So your mother died when you were 12. Your father mm-hmm. worked, 12 hours a day at the mill. Who took care of you?
Nobody. I just stayed at home, and I would kind of, you know, when you're young like that, you kind of, you see things that's not there, you know. So I kept the radio going all the time, you know. Even at night, I'd go to sleep with it. And if I woke up during the night, well, I'd listen to it a while. And it's always on one of those old border stations from down in Mexico or the Grand Ole Opry. And I just grew up on that old music. And I almost had a photographic memory. And I remembered most of those songs. And I still do remember most of them. And I never wanted to sing anything but those songs because they sort of helped me make it, you know, through life.
Is there a song that you found particularly comforting when you were home alone at night and a little afraid and you'd put on the radio?
Well, I liked the old heart songs and the ballads more than I did the boogie woogies and things like that. But I think, you know, back in those days, the B movies and the old radio programs that they had, they depicted life, I think, just a little bit better than what it is. And I think today the music we hear, a lot of it, and a lot of the movies that we see depict life a lot worse than what it really is, you know. And I think that's where I got most of my raising was from listening to those songs. I remember Eddie Arnold had a song out one time. It called "We're Rocking Alone in an Old Rocking Chair," and it was about neglected grandmother. And after listening to that, I said, boy, I'll never let mine do that.
Can you sing a couple of lines of that?
Yeah, let me get my guitar here. Rocking alone in an old rocking chair, I spied an old mother with silvery hair. She seemed so neglected as I saw her there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. Her hands were calloused, withered and old. A life of hard work was the story they told. And I thought of angels as I saw her there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. It wouldn't take much to gladden her heart, just some small remembrance on somebody's part. A card or a letter would brighten life there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair. I know some kids in an orphan's home who'd think they owned heaven if she were their own. They'd never be glad to let her sit there, rocking alone in an old rocking chair.
Oh, that sounds great. Thank you so much for singing that for us. I think I can really understand why you alone without a mother would so relate to this song about a woman alone who is neglected.
Well, that's kind of the why I love these old songs, because and why I try to keep them alive.
So when did you get a guitar? I mean, your family was poor.
that's another story. There's a cousin of mine, J.R. Wright was his name. He married one of my cousins, and I used to get up in a tree, you know, when I'd come home from school, even before Mother died, I would get up in that tree and sing, because I just had to sing, you know, every day, and I had to find a place where I could do it, because I was kind of ashamed to do it in front of anybody, and I'd get up in the tree and sing. And sometimes I'd stay up there till after dark, and then I'd get down and come in the house after dark. But I remember that years later I would meet some of the folks from home, and they'd say, oh, you're the little guy that used to get up in the tree and sing. And I didn't realize they was even listening to me. And my kin folks would always make me sing because they enjoyed what I sung. But they all said, you need to learn how to play guitar. And J.R. Wright bought me an old Stella guitar way back when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And, of course, I didn't have a book to learn from, and I learned how to grip it like a club instead of pushing your hand out and playing it right, you know. But I'd learned I went to a Tex Ritter movie and learned the C chord. I got to watching where his fingers were, and some guy down the street knew three or four chords, and I just sort of learned it from other people and watching them, and I really learned it the wrong way. If I'd have been able to, you know, afford a teacher or something, I'd probably been. I'm still not a very good guitar player. I can just sort of get by.
My guest is Don Walser. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer and guitarist Don Walser. Now, I know that where you grew up was not far from Lubbock.
That's
of course,
right.
Lubbock's big star was Buddy Holly. And I know now, that there were times you shared a bill with him, right?
Oh, yes. Of course, back then I didn't really know who he was, but there was a drive-in theater there in La Mesa, Texas that Skeet Nart had this old drive-in called a Skyview. And, in fact, it's still operating. It's one of the last ones that hadn't been closed down. And he had a ramp house where you could go sit in the wintertime and watch it instead of running your heater in your car, and you had seats that you could watch through the glass in the ramp house. Then he had a big projection room there and he had a little stage on top of it, and he would bring in guys like Hoyle Nix and Buddy Holly, and I would always play with them. You know, each time I would play some, and they'd have a new recording guy, you know, somebody that would come out with a new hit song and that lived in that part of the country, and they would have them come down and play at the Skyview during between the movies, you know, and I would share bills with them. And then also one of his Buddy Holly's first, I don't know if he's a manager or just worked with him, his name was High Pockets Duncan. And I don't know his real name, but he was a disc jockey on KDAV there in Lubbock, and I didn't have a telephone. And he would, he'd get in touch with me. He'd say, some of you folks over there in La Mesa, they called me Donnie back then, said, tell old Donnie Walzer that I want him to be at such and such place at such and such a time. And that's the way I'd get word. Someone would hear it, and they'd come tell me, High Pockets want you to be so in a certain place, you know. And that's kind of the way I found out, in a way. I did share bills with lots of people. And back then, he was just a tall, Buddy Holly was just a tall boy with glasses, and I didn't really realize who he was until many years later.
Did rock and roll make it hard for you to do your music?
Yeah, it put a bunch of us almost out of business there for a while when Elvis and some of those guys came in. And it was good music, and I even did a little of it myself, but it never was, my heart never was there, you know, so just kept doing plugging away at what I do now, you know.
Which Elvis songs did you do?
Oh, Heartbreak Hotel and some of those, three or four of them. Just enough to satisfy some of the young girls that was in the crowd.
do a couple of bars of Heartbreak Hotel the way you do
boy.
It.
I don't even know if I can do it anymore. It's been so many years. Let's see. I don't even I got to find the right key here. Well, since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell. Down at the end of Lonely Street, Heartbreak Hotel. I get so lonely, baby. I get so lonely. I get so lonely, I could die. That's not very good, but
that's great. So there was a period when you felt like Elvis and other rock and rollers were starting to put you out of business. What did you do?
Well, we just kept playing. We would do a few of those songs. And I love Chuck Berry. We used to do a lot of Chuck Berry songs. And not a lot of them, but a few enough to get us through the night, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, I think that old rock and roll music was great music. And I still love to hear it. We got a group here in Austin called the High Noon Boys that do that stuff. They even made a 78 RPM record not too long ago using the old tube stuff that they used to record with back in those days.
Did you ever want to be the young singer who was really good looking and all the girls fell for, and you know, to become a big like romantic hero as well as a singer?
I think all of us did that going. I had the star syndrome there for a couple of years until I realized that I was having more fun than the stars were, you know. I was getting to play for weddings and old VFW halls and getting right there with the people, and I didn't have to worry about Carnegie Hall or any of those places. But I did have to take my wife. I told her when we married, I said, I'm in the National Guard, and I'll stay there till I retire, and I'm going to be gone some each year to go to summer camp. And I said, I'm going to play my music all my life. And so you got to get used to that. And if you don't trust me, then you've got to go with me. And I sort of insisted when we were young that she'd go with me. And so she could see that I was straight. You know what I mean? But I wasn't a bad-looking old boy when I was younger and had a few pounds off of me, and I did have a few of them try to chase me, but they always was afraid of my wife. You know how that goes.
So she did travel with you through the years?
Oh, yeah, she went everywhere I went back in those days. Now she doesn't go to every place. She comes out to a couple of places and helps me sell what products we have and so forth. But she trusts me now after all these years, and she says I'm like an old dog chasing a car anyway. If a dog caught the car, he couldn't drive it anyway.
Don Walser recorded in 1994. His latest CD is called Down at the Skyview Drive-In. It's named after the drive-in where he used to perform in the 50s. Let's hear a song from it.
Pardon me if I'm sentimental when we say goodbye. Don't be angry with me should I cry. Though you're gone, yet I'll dream a little dream as years roll by. Now and then, there's a fool such as I. Now and then, there's a fool such as I am. Love, and now you say that we are through. I'm a fool, but I love you, dear, until the day that I die.
Now and then
there's a fool such as I.
There's a fool such as I.
Our Country Music Week series continues tomorrow with three of the founders of the country outlaw movement, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and Billy Joe Shaver. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Helen Keller. This is Fresh Air. How did Helen Keller almost destroy her saintly reputation? According to a new biography by Dorothy Herman, the answer is by publicly advocating birth control, women's rights, and socialism, and at the end of her life by indulging in martinis and mink coats. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Herman's nuanced portrait of Helen Keller is no joke.
In the preface to her rich and compelling biography of Helen Keller, Dorothy Herman says that over the past few years, she's been subjected to a lot of those dumb Helen Keller jokes. I also heard those jokes recently whenever I'd mention whose biography I was reading. But I also heard something else. At least five women said to me, "Oh, Helen Keller, I read everything about her when I was a kid." I wonder about this obsession with Helen Keller that so many girls, myself included, seem to have experienced. Certainly Helen was a safe female for us to have admired. She was smart and indomitable, but her blindness and deafness rendered her dependent, thus ensuring that her strengths didn't overwhelm her femininity. After finishing Herman's biography, I also suspect that Annie Sullivan had a lot to do with our fascination with Helen's story. A story that goes like this. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful child lost in emptiness. Then one day, a young woman, also beautiful, comes along and rescues her. She takes the place of the child's ineffectual mother. Forever after, she barely leaves her side. As Herman vividly chronicles, Helen's singular relationship with Annie Sullivan sounds like a fantasy about the perfect mother, as well as a chaste fairy tale romance. At times, however, their relationship also felt like a dungeon to the two women, one they each sporadically tried to escape. There are also a couple of princes bearing threatening, slobbering kisses in Herman's unexpurgated life of Helen Keller, but they didn't stick around long enough to loosen the tormented love knot that bound Helen and Annie. Sex and politics are the two biggest bombshells Herman drops in this biography. Helen once told her friend Alexander Graham Bell that she couldn't imagine a man wanting to marry her. She said, "I should think it would seem like marrying a statue." Nevertheless, in 1914, when she was 36, Helen and her 29-year-old male secretary, Peter Fagan, fell in love. The romance was a secret one. Helen knew that her mother, and especially Annie Sullivan, who, as Herman points out, derived her identity and livelihood from their association, would never have approved. So Helen and Fagan planned to elope, going so far as to apply for a marriage license in Boston. Their scheme was eventually exposed, and Fagan disappeared. But Herman speculates that, given the socialist, free love circles the pair moved in, their affair was consummated. Helen Keller, a socialist? A wobbly who hailed the birth of the Soviet Union and palled around with the likes of John Reed and Emma Goldman? Those grammar school hagiographies that we girls lapped up tactfully omitted mention of Helen's radical leanings. It was Annie's husband, John Macy, another male who eventually realized he was the third wheel in a relationship built for two, who introduced Helen to socialism. Whenever she expressed her beliefs, however, the public scoffed. How could a deaf-blind woman know anything about politics? Instead, Helen's audience only wanted uplifting accounts of her courageous life. I've shortchanged Annie Sullivan here, but fortunately Herman doesn't. Like many others who've studied Helen and her teacher, Herman believes that Annie was the truly brilliant partner in the relationship, especially given that she fought her way out of her own version of the darkness that imprisoned Helen. Herman graphically describes Annie's childhood spent in a poorhouse where she shared quarters with sexually abusive adults as well as corpses. Ironically, her escape was bought at the price of her personal freedom. Annie suffered daily from headaches and nausea after hours and hours of spelling the world into Helen's demanding hand. Annie once admitted that she and the adult Helen had such fundamentally different conceptions of life that they would have loathed each other had they met under ordinary circumstances. Nonetheless, the image Herman leaves readers with is of Annie and Helen side by side, their ashes interned together at Washington's National Cathedral, like so many other couples, bound for eternity by love and circumstance and chafing mutual dependency.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Helen Keller, A Life. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schurach. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Some folks say, if you keep rolling and you keep it in the yellow line, it'll take you to the big highway.
On the next Fresh Air, our Country Music Week continues with three of the creators of country's outlaw movement, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, and Billy Joe Shaver. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.